that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That's a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to a mini episode of The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, and today I'm returning to my 2023 conversation with Stephanie Land, author of Class, a memoir of motherhood, hunger, and higher education. Stephanie will be a guest of Chapter 1 Bookstore on February 2nd for an event at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Hamilton, Montana. For more information about this event, head to chapter1bookstore.com. Made, Stephanie's first memoir, was centered on her life as a working mother, as a house cleaner, but it was also a story about her dreams. In the immensely readable Class, Stephanie takes us with her as she pursues that dream, as she finishes college. Facing barriers at every turn, including a Byzantine loan system, not having enough money for food, navigating the judgments of professors and fellow students, Land finds a way to survive once again. Stephanie, thank you so much for being here. Welcome back to The Right Question.
Thank you for having me. It's really great to be here.
I want to begin by congratulating you on the publication of your second memoir, Class. And I want to congratulate you on the success of Made, your first memoir that was not only a New York Times bestseller, but it also became the inspiration for a Netflix series. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's enormous. Yeah. What does the success of Made and this initial reception of Class mean, that your stories have been so embraced by the public in the way that they have and will probably continue to be?
Boy, what does it all mean? I don't know yet. I mean, I feel like I'm very much still in the thick of it. Like, it's only been 5 years. And I kind of went immediately from low-income housing to traveling around New York City in a car, like, and everybody's asking me if I've had water. And just, like, it was this really weird kind of startling experience to get thrown into. And I've been going nonstop. I work as a public speaker. I do a lot of events that are unpaid and are fall more into advocacy. And it was a little weird to, like, sit down and write a book again, just because so much of my job has become talking, which is nothing that I would have imagined for myself personally, just because I'm so introverted. So when it came time to write Class last summer, I thought, you know, I have the platform, I have kind of the clout to be a little bit different in this book and to be angry. So I'm experimenting, I guess, with this story, and I'm interested to see what the reaction's going to be from the general public. So far, it's been pretty good, but it'll be interesting.
You called yourself an introvert, and in Class, you write, when talking about a storytelling class with Deborah Erling, that you never really considered the possibility of performance or, in some respects, public speaking a part of being a writer. I'm wondering, how was that transition for you? Was it kind of a shock to the system? Was it an easy transition? Did you fall into that role pretty easily, or has it taken some time to kind of get used to that part of your writing life?
I'm glad you picked up on that line, because I definitely put that in there, because I do remember thinking that, and now it's just almost ironic that that's my job. I don't know if I will ever fully get used to it. It is something that is very hard on me. It's very hard on my mental health. It's hard on my family because I'm traveling all the time. It is something that I hope to not be my main day job at some point in my life. So, I mean, right now it's like, get it while the getting's good, but, you know, eventually I would like to settle down and not travel for work all the time. It's really hard. I'm good at it. I don't know how. I'm very rehearsed, maybe, because I've done, I think events are almost at around 100. Or more, I don't know. I honestly don't know. so it's been a thing.
You write in class, which sees you struggling to work a part-time job on top of getting your bachelor's degree and finding childcare for your six-year-old, that, quote, I got the sense that not only did work have the greatest value, but that I too only had value if I was working. You're talking about work and the strain that the work you do now on top of writing has on your body. And both this book, Class, and your first book, Made, center your struggle to find and maintain work to keep your daughter clothed and fed and happy. And I'm wondering how you view work now, how you view that labor now, how you think about it in relationship to or in balance with your family life. It sounds like maybe it has both changed and not.
Yeah. So during the pandemic, I signed the contract for Class right before the pandemic started. And then I proceeded to, you know, experience a pandemic like everybody else. But I also had 4 pregnancy losses that year. And I could not produce. I could not write. And that really messed with me, because I wrote Made in this tiny little dark apartment in low-income housing. I was a single mom. And I'm writing about a time that was the hardest year of my life. And I wrote so much. Like, I printed out everything that I wrote that year. And the stack was like 2 inches of paper. And I really struggled with a lot of negative self-talk of just like, look at you. You're in a much more privileged place. You have a house, you have a spouse, you have, you know, a way better laptop, like, you know, like all of this stuff. And I could not write. And I realized that I still very fundamentally only saw myself as having value if I was actively able to work. And I think I've just come to recognize that that is just a part of me now, because a part of the book of Class and part of the reason why I chose that year in particular is because I was kicked off of food stamps because I couldn't fulfill the work requirement as a full-time student. I learned recently that that has slightly changed. There's now an exemption for single parents who are full-time college students. The age has gone up from 6 to age 12. So I that wouldn't have happened now. I still would have needed childcare, and I still would have really struggled with that. But the part where I am working as hard as I possibly can, and I get this letter in the mail that says, none of that matters. Sorry, you can't eat. And it's just, it really messed with me. And I probably will never know just how much that defined me. But I don't know if there will ever be a way for me to just like not work. You know, I have anxiety, but it's also like this just need to be contributing in society, to like to have a place, to have value. I mean, we assign so much dignity to our jobs and just as a society. And I think that's really horrible, because every job, every type of work is important to your community especially. And I think that part of the government assistance programs, the work requirements, where you have to work 20 hours a week in order to get food and food stamps, like it comes out to be a little bit over $1 a person per meal per day. And like, that's the average. And so it's really messed up. And it really messed me up.
Well, it sounds too that, you know, you're talking about this value that society places on work and the labor and that place in our communities, but you're also coming from a background of extreme instability. And so those things are probably working in tandem to sort of increase your anxiety about not working. If you're not working, you're not making money, you're not working towards stability.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is extremely purposeful. I think America is in a caste system. You know, I think that there is a lot of purpose in keeping a class of society who is desperate for work, and they're sick, they're poor, they don't have access to education. All other work is possible because we have this workforce who cleans up after us and serves us and takes care of our kids. And their whole purpose, their whole job is to make our lives easier. And without that, you know, everything would fall apart, but nobody wants to do those jobs. And so they have to keep this whole entire low wage population desperate for jobs. And so I was there for a long time.
Stephanie, I'm hoping you might read something from class.
I haven't read this since I recorded the audiobook, so. Since Amelia had arrived, our lives had been relentless. I knew that some people lauded us as an example of true resilience. It seemed to me that these people viewed living below the poverty line as a kind of strength training program. Most were likely unaware of how all-encompassing it was for us. They didn't see their participation in how we were trained, but any time I talked about or posted on Facebook that I was going through a hard time, all the comments were some variation of, "You got this." With every hardship we endured, and in turn every traumatic incident that I had to relay in order to give someone a heads up that my kid needed trauma-informed care, what I heard most as a response was that I should be proud for getting through it. I was a survivor. I was resilient. People would tell me children are resilient when I worried about Amelia, but I never saw how that could be true. Children didn't have the communication skills or self-awareness to talk to adults about how stressful their lives felt, or that they couldn't in fact handle it. That lack of ability, that silence, seemed to be confused with resilience. This resilience might have been part of what made my writing unique, but it still bothered me that it was part of my life. Resilience as a virtue is assigned, especially to marginalized groups, when systemic structures have created countless invisible barriers to living what the privileged consider a normal life. Every time I wanted to cry from the crushing hopelessness that life seemed to bring, something inside of me hissed, "You must not allow yourself to fall apart." At first, I thought this signified bravery on my part, or that it meant I was a good parent in that I didn't want my kid to worry as much as I did about keeping us fed, clothed, and sheltered. Then I started to realize that I had no choice in the matter. I didn't have the privilege to feel. So this whole section, like I called it the resilience soapbox, it's not a virtue. It is just people telling you, this is what we're offering you. This is what you have to work 20 hours a week for, and we'll give you this small amount. And you've got to be good with that, because if you complain, we're just going to lose your paperwork or not want to work with you. Or, you know, I was trained to be very small and like this Oliver Twist type of person, because that's who, you know, the quote unquote deserving poor is.
That was memoirist Stephanie Land, author of Class, a memoir of motherhood, hunger, and higher education, out now from Atria One Signal Publishers, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. Stephanie will be a guest of Chapter One Bookstore on February 2nd for an event at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Hamilton, Montana. For more information about this event, head to chapteronebookstore.com. You've been listening to a mini episode of The Right Question. This show was produced by me, I'm your host, Lauren Korn, and Chris Moyles engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.